Welcome to the ICE 2020 Virtual Annual Conference. This is our CMS update session. I would now like to introduce today's moderator, Mike Myers, ICE Board President and Director of Agency Relations.
Thank you, Anthony. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's session. Before we get started and introduce our speakers, I'd like to, on behalf of myself and ICE, would like to thank PCG Software, our exclusive gold sponsor for this session. PCG's virtual examiner software suite assists payer organizations nationwide in meeting regulatory and compliance requirements for cost containment, fraud and abuse, provider profiling, quality assurance, and payer transparency. Thank you again to PCG Software. Now on to our CMS keynote session and our keynote speakers. First, I would like to introduce Ann Duarte. Ann Duarte is the Group Director for CMS's San Francisco, Seattle, Drug and Health Plan Operations Group. She and her team collaborate across multiple CMS components to oversee and monitor regulatory compliance of Medicare Advantage organizations, prescription drug plans, PACE plans, California's Medicare and Medicaid plans, and commercial insurers offering coverage in the health insurance exchange under the Affordable Care Act. And is also leading the Medicare Account Management Business Function Committee, currently focused on implementing continuous improvement across Medicare Parts C and D oversight. Also, we have the pleasure of hearing from Dr. Wolf. Dr. Wolf is a board-certified family physician and serves as co-chief medical officer for the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services, offices in Denver, San Francisco, and Seattle. Dr. Wolf has been based in CMS San Francisco since 2015, and now also supports the Denver and Seattle regional office locations in her focus on the implementation of Medicare and Medicaid policy across the Western states and the Pacific territories. As a senior medical advisor for CMS programs in the Western United States, she provides clinical expertise to the divisions of Medicare and Medicaid payment policy, quality improvement, survey operations, contracted health plan, and serves as the principal liaison with the clinical community. So we'll turn it over to you, ladies. Thank you so much for today's presentation.
Thank you, Mike, for the opportunity to represent CMS San Francisco at the conference again this year. Believe it or not, I think for the 14th time. You've done a great job adapting to the circumstances, and I'm happy to be part of this year's event, even if it's only just downstairs from my husband and kids. Cross my fingers that they're not making too much noise or decide that this is a great time for a cameo appearance. I'm also pleased to join my colleague, Dr. Ashby Wolf, who will follow me with a presentation on the agency's response to COVID-19 pandemic. But before I turn things over to her, I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about some of the initiatives underway within drug and health plan operations that we believe are positively impacting our own industry collaboration effort to improve Medicare C and D operations and the services so many of you provide to our beneficiaries. As Mike mentioned, just a few months ago, I took over as the lead of the Medicare Account Management Business Function Committee within Drug and Health Plan Operations. All of our business function committees are national committees designed to oversee and improve various internal operations, including those related to Medicare account management, exchange account management, casework resolution, PACE oversight, Medicare program audits, and drug and health plan operations internal controls. The Medicare Account Management Business Function Committee is our first of these committees to learn and adopt the concepts of continuous improvement. And by continuous improvement, I mean the lean process that's a never-ending strive for perfection by focusing on enhancing the activities that generate the most value while removing as many waste activities as possible. The key to this is going to the people who actually do the work to find out what improvements we need to make. That means we are asking our account managers to identify best practices in communicating with colleagues within the agency and with you, our plan sponsors, best practices in accessing and interpreting the reports and data that are available to them. Best practices in reviewing complaints we receive through the Medicare call center and identifying complaint trends and then working with you on those. Best practices in anticipating and responding to potential issues. And then using that experience and the successes there to develop what we call standard work, which is a roadmap for all of our account managers to follow consistently to be effective and efficient in all that they do. If you're a compliance officer at a drug or health plan, you may have noticed an uptick in your interaction with your account manager as we approach the new benefit year starting January 1st. We've always asked about the changes you're implementing for your existing members and then for the new members in terms of benefits and costs. But this year, based upon the new benefit year standard work, the account managers are also asking about potential PBM changes, pharmacy network changes, formulary changes, Part C or D platform changes, service area changes, acquisitions, non-renewals, and projected enrollment. We're asking about your oversight of your vendors and contractors. Are you on top of their performance carrying out your obligations? How and how often do you measure their service levels? And what corrections are you requiring if they fall short? We're reviewing your members' complaints to 1-800-MEDICARE to identify trends that might indicate that things are not going as smoothly as they should. We're monitoring online enrollment center data and checking in with you about delinquent files. We're monitoring your enrollment volume weekly and reaching out to ask about your strategies to handle enrollment increases that are significantly higher than where you were on October 1st. In fact, as of this week, we know that 6 of our plan sponsors across the country are seeing January 1 enrollments 25 to 49% higher than where they were on October 1st. And 8 plan sponsors have enrollments of 50% or more over October 1 levels. 4 of those are seeing their enrollments more than double. With this enrollment growth in mind, account managers are asking, how are you doing on call center staffing? How about sending enrollment letters to new members and getting member materials into their hands? What about uploading 4RX data? And how generally are you preparing to provide access to services to all of these members starting on January 1st? From the management perspective, perhaps the most exciting thing about our increased engagement through this standard work is that we're collecting all of this information in one place. In addition to the enrollment growth I just mentioned, we know that 9 plan sponsors will make Part C system or platform changes on January 1. 14 sponsors have outstanding non-compliance issues that may affect them significantly on January 1. 10 are making changes to delegated entities. 22 will see significant benefit changes on January 1. There will be 12 acquisitions, 15 non-renewing contracts, and 4 consolidations. 11 sponsors will change PBMs on January 1, and 6 will have significant pharmacy network changes. All of this research and coordination is to ensure that we're all thinking about and planning for the new year, that we're identifying potential risks and developing mitigation strategies, minimizing the chances of something going horribly wrong that harms your members, that makes news headlines, the kind that you have nightmares about, we do too, and that threatens the stability of the program. That's just the standard work that's getting us ready for the new year. On top of that, we are testing additional continuous improvement standard work for account managers to roll out early next year. So you can all expect increased engagement from your account managers in 2021, initially for those areas that we believe most significantly impact your members, but as time goes by, for all aspects of account management. Now, CMS can't execute continuous improvement in isolation. While we think of our beneficiaries as our ultimate customer, you're a customer as well. And so I hope that you will provide feedback and ideas to your account manager on how to improve our collaborative effort in ways that will support efficiency with an oversight of our program and get us closer to the perfection that we seek. Now, as the opening act, I gladly turn the rest of our time over to Dr. Ashby Wolf, Chief Medical Officer, and we'll both be happy to answer any questions you have after her presentation. Ashby?
Thank you so much, Anne, and it's a pleasure to be here with you all today. I actually have some slides to share with this presentation, and I'm going to be following up Anne's presentation with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic, an overview of what CMS has been doing in terms of its response. We're going to go ahead and move through past slide two, which is just a brief disclaimer. Things at CMS are changing on an almost daily basis, not just with respect to COVID-19, but with respect to a lot of our other rules and regulations. And so this presentation and the handout that you have access to, it's the same version of the slides, just in PDF form. This presentation is up to date as of right now, but of course, as things change, this information will change as well. And so within the presentation are a number of resources, links for you, et cetera, that you should be able to take advantage of and follow up as needed. All right, perfect. Let's go ahead and move to the next slide, which will provide an overview of our objectives today. I'm going to describe a little bit about the key initiatives at CMS at this time, including just a refresher on some of the most recent policy that we've issued, and then dive into the work that we've done to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. And then, as Anne mentioned, we should have time for questions. Next slide, please. So, of course, CMS has been working in a number of areas over the course of the last several years to promote everything from EHR interoperability to data transparency to patient-centeredness. And our work, of course, impacts all of our stakeholders, beneficiaries, clinicians, health plans, facilities, et cetera, in a variety of ways. And specifically, with respect to our health plan colleagues, we are working to align our program with commercial and state Medicaid plans in order to ensure that there is seamless coordination across payers, that the sharing of health information can happen seamlessly, and that there is a trusted exchange and communication of that information. The next slide provides an example of some of this work with respect to the update of the evaluation and management guidelines for coding and documentation. As many of you are aware, CMS has been working to address clinician concern with the outdated 95 and 97 E&M guidelines for several years now. And in the fall of 2019, we published our updated policies, which will go into effect January 1, 2021. Specifically, we finalized aligning outpatient evaluation and management visit coding and documentation policies with those changes recommended by the American Medical Association CPT editorial panel. Specifically, this includes things like code redefinitions that rely on time and medical decision making, as well as deleting the level one new patient code and adding a new prolonged services code. And information about these changes can be found not only on our website, but there are a number of helpful resources, webinars that confer continuing education credits on the AMA CPT E&M webpage. And those links are here for you for your review. In addition, on the next slide, a summary of some of the work that CMS is doing to align our efforts around quality improvement and quality measurement. Obviously, there's a lot of burden with quality measurement these days. There's thousands of quality measures, some of which align well with scopes of practice and the work that clinicians are doing, others of which don't really represent either the clinician's work or the patient's goals of care. And so as part of this collaborative, CMS has been working to focus quality measurement on improving patient health outcomes, reducing burden, and eliminating redundancies. And in September, CMS, in collaboration with its partners in the Core Quality Measures Collaborative, released four updated measure sets, as you can see here, related to gastroenterology, infectious disease, OBGYN, and pediatrics. And the idea with these updates is to support physician participation in value-based arrangements to provide steady income, reward high quality and efficient care, and of course, reduce administrative burden when it comes to reporting quality data. We do have additional core sets that are planned in the future related to oncology, orthopedics, primary care, cardiology, behavioral health, and neurology. So more information about these changes is available via the link on this slide. And the link also provides information to an implementation guide for those stakeholders who are seeking to implement or evolve value-based arrangements. Next slide, please. Now, of course, all of this work was happening in the early spring this year, and then we had the COVID-19 pandemic hit hard. And so the work at our agency really shifted in response to the pandemic. You all, I'm sure, are very much aware of all of the work that CMS has done through our 1135 waivers and other regulatory actions in order to address and provide for the response. These waivers and flexibilities really are put into place to ensure that there is sufficient healthcare items and services available to be provided to meet the needs of Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP beneficiaries, and to ensure that our clinicians and facilities that provide such services can do so in good faith and can be reimbursed. We do have a website where we are constantly updating our changes as the pandemic continues to evolve. So again, would point you to the CMS Current Emergencies website. If you haven't visited it recently, I will actually be speaking to some recent updates and providing some additional resources for you. Next slide, please. So, of course, many of you are probably familiar with the 1135 waiver process, but just briefly to set the stage, this is the way that CMS makes changes to our regulations in light of a national emergency or a natural disaster. And these waivers can only be in place if two things happen. One, if the president declares a national emergency, and two, the Secretary of Health and Human Services also declares that public health emergency under legislation. Now, both of these requirements were met in March, and Secretary Azar has renewed the declaration of the public health emergency again on October 23rd, which will take us through into the new year. The public health emergency is now set to expire on January 21st of 2021, unless, of course, it is renewed again. And any waivers or flexibilities that CMS issues are in effect until the public health emergency ends. Next slide. Now, of course, these 1135 waivers also have very specific scope and purpose. They're not designed to last forever, and they are specifically in place to allow for reimbursement during an emergency or a disaster in the event that clinicians and providers cannot comply with other requirements that would otherwise be in place during the course of normal business. So these are not grants or financial assistance. These are not allowing for reimbursement of services that would otherwise not be reimbursable or not be covered. It does not allow individuals who are not eligible for Medicare to become eligible, and it does not impact any response decisions. So at the local level, if a community or a set of providers were going to respond to an emergency in a certain way, these waivers are not designed to get in the way of that response or to impact that response at all. Next slide. So CMS has issued a number of blanket waivers, all of which are effective retroactive to March 1st. I'm sure this is not new information for you, but as I mentioned earlier, our information is continuing to be updated as our response to the pandemic evolves. And so these resources that are provided here continue to be updated on a regular basis. And I would encourage you all to continue to check these details as needed. On the next slide is just an example of some of the topics that we cover in our blanket waivers. Obviously, telehealth is a huge area of flexibility that continues to be in place over time, as well as our support for waiving regulations to allow hospitals and other facilities to build surge capacity in response to the pandemic. We've also worked to expand the health system workforce and allow for clinicians to participate in the care of patients from a variety of locations, even out of state. And we've also worked to expand in-place testing and reduce reporting and other administrative burdens in the face of the pandemic. Next slide, please. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time on telehealth, even though this is not necessarily new information for you. I just want to review because it is really increasingly important, and many, many clinicians and organizations are taking advantage of these flexibilities, which is really leading to an evolution in the way that we provide care to patients. So as As you all know, CMS has waived a number of our regulations around telehealth to allow clinicians and patients to provide and receive care from a variety of locations. So we've waived our geographic site restrictions. We've allowed for clinicians to provide care to patients either from their office setting or from their home. Patients can then receive those services in a variety of settings, including their home. We've also waived the site of service originating site requirements, as well as the restrictions on the types of clinicians who can provide these services. We've also used our authority to allow for certain telehealth services to be provided via audio only technology. And as a result of all these changes, the telehealth use has really expanded. Just as an example, before the public health emergency, Medicare beneficiaries, about 14,000 patients received a Medicare telehealth service in a given week. And during the public health emergency, just between early March and mid-July, over 10 million Medicare beneficiaries received a telehealth service in this way. And we're continuing to see those numbers increase over time. The next slide just provides a little bit more information about the telehealth visits and specifically coding, more references for you, of course, to dig into the details of billing. But as I mentioned, there are no payment restrictions on clinicians who are furnishing these telehealth services, even if they choose to do so from their home. And we've heard a tremendous amount of feedback from clinicians that has really allowed not only the mitigation of risk of transmission of COVID-19, but it's allowed for more rapid response to patients in their home. Of course, we've also allowed these telehealth services to be furnished using telecommunications technology with audio-video capability, and that includes, to a large degree, things like FaceTime, Skype, Google Hangouts. This is in collaboration with the Office of Civil Rights, which has waived some of the requirements so that clinicians can and interact with patients in a way that meets that beneficiary's needs without necessarily being out of compliance with HIPAA. So again, more information about this via the links that you see on the slide if you should choose to need them. Next slide, please. And as I mentioned, our response to the pandemic has continued to evolve over time. And this also is not necessarily new for you, but just a reminder that as we continue to see the pandemic and the response evolve at the clinician level, we are continuing to update our regulations. And that has included things like increasing payment for services that are provided via audio only, and allowing for certain telehealth services to be provided in either an audio video format or in an audio only format. Next slide. This is just an example of some of the telehealth services that we've worked to expand over the course of the public health emergency, including the provision of services like group psychotherapy, cognitive assessment and care planning services, allowing for clinicians to bill for visit complexity that is provided in the telehealth setting, critical care services, as well as many other inpatient-based services, and of course, emergency department visits and home visits as well. And for those of you who have been paying attention to some of the learning collaboratives around the country and best practices, there's a lot of learning that's going on with respect to how you do good care well in the telehealth environment. And this is not an exhaustive list, of course. If you can find the full list of current telehealth services that are being reimbursed under Medicare via the link here on this slide. Next slide, please. Of course, with respect to documentation during the public health pandemic, we have also made some allowances for changes in documentation in order to support clinicians and decrease administrative burden by removing any requirements for documenting the history and or physical exam to the degree appropriate. Of course, it does remain our expectation that clinicians will document their visits with patients in a telehealth setting as is necessary to ensure quality of care and continuity of care. And of course, this policy only applies to those outpatient visits furnished via telehealth during the public health emergency. These changes and flexibilities are actually in somewhat similar to the policies that will be put in place on January 1 with respect to outpatient evaluation and management services, which I referenced at the beginning of the presentation. So there is some alignment there. Now, there are also some specific flexibilities with respect to Medicare Advantage and Part D plans, which are detailed on the next slide. Specifically, CMS has allowed Medicare Advantage plans to expand telehealth services and other mid-year benefit enhancements beyond those which were included in your approved 2020 benefits. We've also allowed for Part D sponsors to waive prior authorization requirements at any time for what they would otherwise apply to Part D drugs that would be used to treat or prevent COVID-19 should and if those drugs are in fact identified. And of course, we've also made some very specific flexibilities that Medicare Advantage organizations are not permitted to charge cost sharing for testing, for the detection of or the diagnosis of COVID-19, the administration of such tests, and the specified testing related services. And so of course, in addition, Medicare Advantage organizations may not impose any prior authorization or utilization management requirements with respect to those specific services as well. And of course, more information and details about these flexibilities are available for you via the link on the bottom of slide 17. Now, of course, many clinicians and organizations are also participating in the quality payment program, one of the key shifts of the Medicare Part B policies towards more value-based payment. And so here on this slide, you can see that we've also made some allowances for the challenges that clinicians and organizations are experiencing in reporting data under the quality payment program during the 2020 performance year. And clinicians that are significantly impacted by this public health emergency may submit an extreme and uncontrollable circumstances application to CMS to reweight their performance in a variety of the categories of MIPS. Requesting this exception will essentially allow a clinician to be held harmless during the 2020 performance year and avoid any negative payment adjustments. But you do need to apply and specifically state how you've been impacted by the emergency in order to be granted the exception. Yeah, in fact, today we did just release the fact that this application opportunity is available now until February 1st of 2021. Previously, this application was only going to be available until the end of this calendar year, but we did just announce today that we've extended the submission window until February 1st of 2021. So more information about this is, of course, available on the QPP website. And of course, more information about opportunities that clinicians can take advantage of with respect to their participation in clinical trials or other ways that we are working to collect data regarding the pandemic response is also available through our improvement activities inventory. On the next slide, it's actually a bit of a segue here, but many clinicians and organizations that are participating in quality payment program may also be involved in one or more innovation center models. And this slide just summarizes how many models are currently active. There's a lot going on. But on the next slide, I do want to reference the fact that we've acknowledged this and made some flexibilities available to participants within CMMI models as well. And this is just by way of an example. Some of the flexibilities that we've allowed for the Medicare ACO Track 1 Plus participants, as well as those participating in next generation ACO, but a comprehensive crosswalk of all of our flexibilities for model participants is available via the link on this slide. But essentially, we've used the variety of principles in order to determine which flexibilities are appropriate for innovation center models. And specifically, we've added flexibilities that either already exist in current model design, flexibilities that ensure equity and consistency across models. We've really worked to minimize the risk to model participants, as well as risk to the Medicare trust funds and to Medicaid programs, and really working to align so that we're minimizing reporting burden in ways that complement and build off already declared flexibilities as outlined in our regulations and waivers that I mentioned earlier. So again, a comprehensive list of these model flexibilities available for you via the link on this slide. Now, I did mention that our response continues to evolve as the pandemic evolves and as we learn more about the various therapeutics, various ways of preventing COVID-19, and other measures are developed. And so this is the most recent information that CMS has issued regarding our response to the COVID-19 pandemic. What we call an interim final rule with comment, we've issued four of these now over the course of the year. And so that is why this particular one is called IFC4, interim final rule with comment number four. It was issued on October 28th, and it does a number of things, including creating flexibilities for states to maintain Medicaid enrollment during the public health emergency. It establishes specific Medicare payments for new COVID-19 treatments. It does address coverage for vaccination, which I'll speak to in just a minute. It also takes steps to ensure that there is transparency with regard to price. It provides an extension of one of our innovation center models, the comprehensive care for joint replacement model, and creates also some flexibilities regarding public notice requirements for innovation waivers. And really what this interim final rule does is creates a comprehensive plan to remove regulatory barriers and ensure consistent coverage and payment for the administration of an eventual vaccine. There are a number of toolkits that were released concurrently with the publication of this interim final rule, which I will reference for you. But a comprehensive list of all those resources is available via the link on the bottom of this slide. So I mentioned that this rule does actually provide specific regulations regarding vaccine coverage. And so that's what this slide really speaks to. As a condition of receiving free COVID-19 vaccines from the federal government, providers will be prohibited from charging consumers for the administration of the vaccine. And really to ensure broad and consistent coverage across payers and programs, we have issued a number of toolkits that have specific information for various programs. So for example, here, with respect to Medicare fee-for-service, beneficiaries with Medicare will pay nothing for COVID-19 vaccines, and their co-payment, co-insurance, and deductible are waived. For Medicare Advantage programs for calendar years 2020 and 2021, Medicare will pay directly for the vaccine and its administration for those who are enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans. And those plans would not be responsible for reimbursing providers to administer the vaccine during these times. In addition, Medicare Advantage beneficiaries pay nothing for their COVID vaccine, and their copayment and coinsurance and deductible are waived. With respect to Medicaid, state agencies must provide administration of the vaccine with no cost sharing for most beneficiaries during the public health emergency, and states may have to evaluate cost sharing policies and submit potentially state plan amendments if updates are needed. For those individuals who are uninsured, clinicians and providers will be able to be reimbursed through the Provider Relief Fund, which is administered by our sister agency, HRSA. Of course, for private plans, CMS, along with the Departments of Labor and the Treasury, are requiring that most private plans and issuers cover a recommended COVID-19 vaccine and its administration, both in-network and out-of-network, with no cost sharing. And we have more information regarding those details via the link on the bottom of this slide. As I mentioned, we have a number of toolkits specifically geared towards all of our stakeholders who may be either administering the vaccine or paying for the administration. Thank you. And so this slide actually provides an overview of where those resources are available. Our vaccine guidance homepage is the first link that you see on this slide, the www.cms.gov/COVIDVax. But specifically for our insurers and health plans, there is a specific toolkit for you as well. And that link is highlighted here for you. Really, these toolkits give clinicians and other stakeholders resources in order to be able to effectively bill and to receive payment for the vaccine. And CMS did actually release Medicare payment rates for vaccine administration. Specifically, those payment rates will be $28.39 to administer single dose vaccines. Of course, for any of you who have been watching the news very carefully, we don't have a single dose vaccine for COVID-19 that's been in the pipeline as of yet. Right now, the front runner vaccines are all two dose vaccines. And so for a COVID-19 vaccine that requires a series of two or more doses, CMS did also release payment rates for that. The initial dose for those payments, the initial dose for those administrations will be $16.94, and then $28.39 for the administration of the final dose in a series. These rates will be geographically adjusted and recognize the costs involved in administering the vaccine, including any additional resources that may be involved with respect to public health reporting, conducting outreach, and patient education. And so these tools here, these toolkits really do provide, the toolkits really do provide information relating to the billing and payment, and specifically with respect to the health plan toolkit, specifically that provides you a list of operational considerations for you all as Medicare Advantage plans as you design your approach to promoting the COVID-19 vaccine. It outlines recent legislative and regulatory provisions that are applicable to issuers. It encourages issuers and MA plans to implement streamlined processes to quickly administer the vaccine. And it just provides some descriptions about how plans and issuers can maximize the number of enrollees who do get vaccinated once we have a vaccine available. So again, these references here for you, as well as a frequently asked question on billing therapeutics available for you on this slide. The next slide does provide some general COVID-19 resources. There is a lot of information out there. And so if you feel a little lost or overwhelmed, I would highly recommend that you take a look at the links on this slide. If you feel like you can't find what you need, we do have a help desk available, COVID-19@cms.hhs.gov. And of course, we are collaborating with our Medicare administrative contractors in the fee-for-service world to ensure that clinicians and providers have what they need. A great frequently asked questions document is also linked for you here on this slide, which is updated on a regular basis. So again, based on questions and queries that we are getting into the email box, we are actually updating the FAQ document with that information as well. Finally, in the last couple of slides, I'd like to highlight some additional items that may be of interest to you, specifically for those of you who are working with vulnerable populations. The Office of Minority Health, specifically our Office of Minority Health, has been working very hard to provide a central location for resources related to COVID-19. And so for specifically, the link here on this slide provides direct information to support those who work with our most vulnerable beneficiaries, specifically those older adults, dual eligibles, those with complex medical conditions, racial and ethnic minorities, people with disabilities. And there's information here not only for healthcare professionals, but also our health plan colleagues, stakeholders, and patients as well. So would encourage you to take a look at that if this does indeed apply to you. On the next slide, also some information specifically geared towards our rural partners, and in particular, supporting rural healthcare surge readiness. So would encourage you to take a look at both of these links because it does provide some additional information and more resources to support the surge, which we do know, in fact, is happening no longer just in rural areas, but in some of our urban areas as well. And that leads me to the last couple of slides here. Here on slide 27, this is a screenshot of what we call our rural crosswalk document, which provides a comprehensive review of COVID-19 flexibilities across various settings. So you can see we list the type of service or the type of flexibility on the left. We describe exactly what that flexibility is. And then we've identified which facilities are most appropriate to take advantage of that. So this is just a screenshot of a few of the telehealth service flexibilities that are listed here in this document. If we go to the next slide, you'll see also that there are a number of additional guidance documents that are actually listed here in the rural crosswalk. So really, this document is not necessarily just for those who are participating in providing services to rural communities, but it actually is a great overview document for everyone. If you're looking for one place to go to see a description of what our flexibilities are and what that guidance might be and where it might apply in terms of types of facilities, this document I would recommend to you as a great resource. And so obviously the link is here on the bottom of the slide. So in addition to our CMS Current Emergencies website, which has the comprehensive list of all of our flexibilities, if you're looking for something that's a little bit more descriptive in terms of what you're looking at, I would recommend that you take a look at this as well. And of course, obviously, as you can see in the description of many of the guidance items that we've listed here, we link the source document for you. So all of that work of hunting around has actually been done for you. And of course, as our response continues to evolve, these documents will also be updated as well. So that's the extent of my update today. We can go ahead and flip to the last slide, which has my contact information on it. And I always say this at the end of my presentations, but if you cannot find what you need, if you do need help, you are welcome to reach out to me. I'm happy to connect you with the group here at CMS that can answer your question, or if lucky enough, I can answer the question myself, I certainly will do so. So with that, again, thank you for your kind attention. And I'll go ahead and turn it back to Mike for our moderation of questions. Thank you.
Anthony, do we have any questions?
All right, we've got a couple of questions that came through our questions box. This is from Tom Bornheimer from Kaiser Permanente. And Tom says, will CMS extend risk adjustment payment for telehealth services beyond the COVID health emergency Also, will CMS provide risk adjustment payment for audio-only telehealth services similar to ACA and FFS payments?
So that's a great question, and I'll take a stab at it, and then Anne, certainly feel free to jump in. There was a lot of feedback that CMS received regarding our existing telehealth policies. And so in the summer, we actually proposed a series of regulatory updates to our telehealth policy in the physician fee schedule proposed rule. We just yesterday published the final rule of the physician fee schedule, which does contain a number of provisions related to extension of telehealth services beyond the public health emergency. Now, I confess, I have not completely read through our final rule, and so I cannot directly quote to you the answer to your question, but I would refer you to our publication of the physician fee schedule final rule, and certainly happy to take that back to our team and get you the answer that you need. So if you do want to shoot me an email with in follow-up, I'm happy to follow up with you to get the specific answer. And I don't know if you can actually give a straight answer or not at this time.
No, I have nothing to add. Thanks.
Okay, great. Next question comes from Anthony Serrano of Aspire Health Plan. And Anthony says, does the administration's emergency declaration renewed on 10/23/2020, further extend the Medicare Advantage Special Election Period, or SEP, for government entity declared disaster or other emergency? Might CMS be able to clarify communication/marketing guidelines for this SEP in particular, as many members who have been impacted by COVID during AEP may be eligible for this SEP?
So thank you for that question. Anne, I'm not sure if you have specifics on this, but the public health emergency declaration, as long as it is standing, it extends the CMS waivers and flexibilities. I do not necessarily believe it extends our special enrollment period policies, but Anne, I'll defer to you.
Ashby, I think that's correct. I don't believe that we have extended those, but I will go back and see if I learn anything different on that. If we have extended them, I'm happy to have our account managers communicate that out to all of our plan sponsors so that you're all aware.
Okay, and we've got a follow-up from Tom Bornheimer from Kaiser Permanente. And the question is there a reason why CMS is paying for telehealth audio-only services for ACA and FFS members, but not for Medicare Advantage members?
So with respect to reimbursement of telehealth, the decision was made to reimburse for audio only certain services because of the challenge that beneficiaries have had with the audio video technology. So that's part of the reason why those flexibilities were updated in one of our earlier interim final rules with comment in April. My understanding is that many Medicare Advantage plans do actually have telehealth as part of their service package. And I can certainly take back the question specifically to understand what the finer points of that decision were. But I don't think that I can provide you much insight at this point in time with respect to those decisions from April, but I'll certainly take that back. Anne, I don't know if you have anything else to add.
No, I don't believe we've carved out, if it's a Medicare covered benefit, I don't believe we've carved that out of Medicare Advantage.
Great. Thank you so much for your presentation today, and all of you in our audience, thank you for your attendance. Stay safe, stay healthy. We wish you a happy holiday. Thank you.